2020, the year in review. 2020 will go down in history for the COVID pandemic, racial justice protests, and an unprecedented national election. The pandemic exposed the fragility of humanity despite and partially because of our global economy, flaws in our healthcare system, and an ever-widening gulf between the fortunate and unfortunate. The election amplified a festering political divide, and it is unclear whether any bridges might connect both sides in the new year. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss 2020 with our panel of Maine editorial page editors, and we'll be joined by historian Ken Davis and journalists from regional papers in the state. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. In approximately 204 hours, 53 and a half minutes, 2020 will be history. But who's counting? Today, we are going to look back at this year in news, and we want to hear which stories mattered most to you in 2020. Joining me to talk about this extraordinary year, Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Greg Kessich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Yes, we would love you to ask a question or give us a comment about 2020. You can send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Usually we do our month in review program on the last day of the month, but Maine Calling will be into rebroadcasts next week. So we're going to do this a little bit early. I think that's okay. I think we have enough news to talk about this year. And I want to start by asking all of you a really broad question and just see if you can find some sort of, some sort of theme or meaning to 2020. I know that everybody in journalism, including us here on Maine Calling, have really spent the year treading water, try to keep our heads above the water and trying to do the best we can every day for our listeners at Maine Calling, your guys' readers. And I realize that it's sometimes very hard to have perspective when you're just trying to do the best you can every single day, but I'm going to make you try. And Ben, as you look back, I'm going to start with you. When you look back at 2020, how do you synthesize it? How do you put it all together?
Well, I really think about 2020 as the year, we've been talking for a long time about the divisions in this country. And I always thought of that as the problem being that we disagree over everything. As soon as an issue comes up, we disagree over it. But I think this is the year that that division really manifested itself in a way that we can see how damaging it is to the country. I mean, I've always gotten calls from people who, thought we made up news stories or thought that we were just, pushing an agenda, and they, wanted to know why we weren't running stories on some issue that they had heard, through talk shows or something that was completely baseless, and wondering why we didn't cover it and see if it was part of something nefarious. But this year, we saw how that division really keeps us from tackling, a huge problem. We got hit with, COVID early on in the year, and it really it was this new thing, and there was a lot of new information, and we really needed people to kind of come together and come to some sort of agreement about how we were going to handle it. And that didn't happen, and we just went over 300. 1,000 deaths. The fallout from that has just been enormous, and so much more than what I think I would have thought at the beginning of the year. I thought before that something like this, we could overcome our divisions and come together, and that didn't happen. I think that's pretty scary.
Susan Young, Ben used the number of more than 300,000 dead nationally. Just this morning here in Maine, another record for new cases reported in one day, more than 700. So although we're not having quite the rates that some other states are, it is still growing and growing here in Maine.
Yeah, it's absolutely horrifying. I mean, obviously the story of the year is the COVID-19 outbreak, but to go a little bit beyond what Ben said, you know, he's spot on. But for me, and I hate to sound like a pessimist, is, you know, the lesson is to always expect the worst. You know, we thought we may be able to get the pandemic under control with people wearing masks and following governor's orders. We had businesses close early in the year, and we took a lot of steps, and I think we all got a little complacent over the summer, and now it feels completely out of control. Fortunately, we're not at the place of some states where their ICU capacity, there is zero. Hospitals are being overrun. It's just this year at every point in time, you know, unfortunately, when we need a president who's strong and has a clear, responsible message before the election, certainly that wasn't happening. And after, we have a president that's completely AWOL. He's not engaged in the biggest crisis to face America, perhaps forever, but at least in a generation. He's, you know, fighting to try and prove that he won the election. He's not trying to solve the problem. Congress largely has been absent. Relief bills helpful, but it's really small, not going to make much difference. And at every turn, it just seems like the worst possible thing can happen. And again, I don't want to sound like a pessimist, but it's been a difficult year for sure.
Greg, you know, we're talking obviously about the COVID pandemic and the election. This is a year in which stories like a major strike at Bath Iron Works, the year that the state legalized marijuana and death with dignity are second, don't even rise to the conversation so far.
Right. I mean, we impeached a president this year. For the third time in history, and it doesn't even make the list of the top stories of the year. I don't want to be like uncharacteristically optimistic, but you know, when I think about this year, especially from the perspective of somebody in the news business, it's been a year when I really felt like there's definitely been voices of people naysaying, not believing the truth or about the election results or about the extent of this pandemic. But, this was a situation where information saved people's lives. And people in the news business were out there, you know, churning out, trying to get the best information to the people as quickly as possible. And to a large extent, with some obvious gaps, I think that succeeded, that the public health information got out to people and they were able to take the steps that that prevented the spread from getting worse. I know that's a weird thing to say on a day when we have again broken another record, but the base that we started from was low enough that we have a chance of containing this until the vaccine is, well distributed.
Sure, Greg, let me talk about that a little bit more, though, because I want to talk about the role of your papers and all of us who are journalists in this year. This has been a really overwhelming year to be a journalist. It is no secret that all of your papers, every paper in America, has had staff cuts. You don't have as many people to be covering this incredibly important time. Every single day, decisions have to be made about what to cover. We're well aware that there are things that we may be missing. And Greg, I just wanted to, I'll start with you and then ask the others. What has it been like to be part of this newsroom and a journalist in 2020?
Well, it's funny the way you ask that, because we don't have a newsroom anymore. Everybody is spread out to the four corners of the globe, and we don't have that sort of sense of community that I've been used to my whole working life. of bumping into people and finding out what they're working on and sharing information. But, you know, it's the mission has been really clear. So that's helpful. I mean, we're really it's very important. As I said earlier, information is saving lives. So, you know, we're part of that. Obviously, you know, we're not like first responders. We're not, we certainly have reporters and photographers who are out there in harm's way. But when I hear the reports about people working in hospitals, you know, the stress that they're under, it seems a degree, 10 degrees more than anything that we're experiencing. But, you know, we're part of this this crisis, you know.
Yeah, Susan.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's at turns, as Greg said, incredibly gratifying. Greg said information is so important early on in the pandemic. We even turned over our opinion pages to just getting information to people. People have lots of questions. So we just answered their questions the best that we could. And people really valued journalism. Our readership subscriptions were up. You know, it's all really great. But at turns, it's also incredibly demoralizing, mostly around the election and the results of the election. You know, there's a growing chorus of people who think we make up the news, that we're just taking cues from the Democratic Party, who I don't even know who runs the Democratic Party right now. So, you know, obviously not true. And, you know, people just refusing to believe the information that we're making it up. We're getting it from government officials, from healthcare providers, from scientists. We're just passing on this information, and it's being met with this resistance that it's all made up. It's a hoax, that we're all liars, and something we really struggle with. How do you work past that? How do you try and communicate with the people who don't believe what we're telling them? And so it's very challenging at the same time.
Ben?
It has been gratifying, I think, to be a small part of this whole process. I mean, the biggest thing that strikes me is that this was brand new. And unless you were one of the small number of journalists who covered public health, which you could probably count on a hand nationwide, this was a brand new thing. And a lot of it was brand new even to the scientists who study it, you know, right? It's a novel coronavirus. And so all of us that were covering it had to learn about it as we go, and not only learn the science, but the politics and all the stuff about epidemiology and all this new stuff coming about. And that does not come easy. That's just, you know, hours and hours of reading and interviewing and talking to people. And journalists around the state have become, you know, experts on this subject in order to bring this information and to be able to ask the right questions. And you know, from our perspective on the editorial board, we've you know, really tried to take pains to put out the right information all the time. And it's hasn't been hard, to be honest. I mean, the right information has been the same for a while. Like Susan was saying, the hardest part about this now, and the reason why it's hard to feel good heading into Christmas, is that this has played out, you know, exactly like people said, and not just once or twice, just kind of all along, you know, like everyone said, we're going to have, you know, if we don't, we'll have this lull in the summer, and that everyone will get overconfident, and that happened, and that we'd have a bump in the fall, and that happened. And so, you know, it's been great to be able to be part of that every day, to get information out. And it's been gratifying to hear from readers who want to hear from us every day, because that's part of their ritual for getting through COVID. But it's also disheartening to see that it only goes so far.
Sure. Well, on the line with us now, one of those reporters in the state of Maine from down east, Sarah Craighead Dedman, who is editor of the Machias Valley News Observer. Sarah, welcome back to Maine Calling, and thank you for being part of today's conversation. Which stories, aside from COVID, were the biggest stories in your part of the state?
Hi, Jennifer. Well, the first one that was indisputably the largest one this year was a triple homicide that took place here in February. As far as I'm able to tell, it's the only known murders that have ever happened in Machias. And three people lost their lives. Four people were shot. That was a man named Thomas Bonfanti. He's still in the Washington County Jail, and the court process has, of course, been held up by COVID-19. So right now, he's just sort of there, and we don't know when his next appearance will be. So that was a big one. That was sad, and that was covered by the statewide media, and really a whirlwind for our little town. But the same month, switching to a happier story, the Machias Memorial High School boys basketball team became the Class D North Regional champs, and that is huge news here, of course. We were really proud of them, and the community was fantastic about it. So they didn't make it to the state. They didn't win the state championship, but there were a lot of underclassmen on that team. So we're really optimistic about coming seasons.
Let me ask you, Sarah, what we were talking about before you came on the program, which was about just the sense of what it was like to be a member of the media, to be a journalist. Did you find at your small local paper the same kind of distrust in the information or not?
I would say yes. I had started early in the pandemic writing a daily article about the status of COVID-19 in Washington County. And I didn't have to do it. I think early on, I didn't actually do it daily because our numbers were scant until November. But once they started, upticking, I've posted them daily, and I've gotten quite a bit of feedback on those, and some of it's been pretty hostile, but mostly it's very appreciative. And so in those articles, we just crunch the numbers and compare the numbers and look at the trends here and the changes. And we have had not a lot of cases. We've kind of hovered toward the bottom of the list in terms of the counties. I think right now there are three that have fewer than we do. But I do get some blowback and some hostility about fear mongering and why aren't we talking about colds or the flu, and we just let it go.
Sarah, before I let you go, are there any stories because of this, tidal wave of other kinds of stories because of COVID, because of the election? Are there stories that you think might have been undercovered this year that were really a big deal?
Yeah, there are, of course, so many, but a couple come to mind. One is the Down East Institute, which is a marine research center on Beals Island. They've selectively bred this extraordinarily beautiful gold mussel, and they're trying to create sort of a side hustle aquaculture opportunity for Maine fishermen to breed these mussels for the to raise them for the high-end restaurant market, because they're just sort of gorgeous. They're gold and black, and they're working with some pilot sites right now. They've just won a grant from Maine Sea Grants, Bowie, Maine program to do marketing. And there's a lot of upside financial opportunity because the United States imports $50 million of mussels just from Prince Edward Island, and Maine only grows about 2 million right now. So that's kind of cool. And the other one is that this was a crazy good year for softshell clams down east. So we won't know the actual numbers until next year, but all those hits to dining and restaurants didn't happen to places that serve a lot of fried clams. And so fishermen here, even lobstermen, turned to the clam flats, and we're expecting to see a really impressive amount of landings next year.
All right. Well, Sarah, it's always so nice to hear from you and hear your perspective. That Sarah Craighead Dedman, editor of the Machias Valley News Observer. We are going to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling. It's the Year in Review. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Springtide Seaweed, committed to offering environmentally friendly aquaculture technologies. SpringtideInnovations.com. Marshall Communications, with Nancy Marshall's The PR Maven podcast, offering advice on building your brand and network, marshallpr.com. And Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine insulation rebates and loans. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
It's tea and candles, cookies and gingerbread houses, walks in the park, and warm woolen scarves. I'm Elena C., and I'm talking about hygge, the Danish concept of contentment. This winter, join me to celebrate that concept with Hygge Holiday, an hour of cozy classics from APM, American Public Media.
And that's coming up Friday morning from 10 to 11 on Maine Public Radio, and Friday afternoon from 1 to 2 on Maine Public Classical. How have your holidays been affected by the pandemic? If you'd like to share your story with Maine Public News, please leave a voicemail at 207-330-4781. Let us know who you are, how, and why your plans have been affected by the spread of COVID-19, and also whether the pandemic has changed the meaning of the holidays for you. Again, the number to call is 330-4781, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, a look back at the year that was 2020. My guest, Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Ben Bragdon, who is editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. We're going to go to Jeannie calling in from Saco. Hi, Jeannie. Go ahead.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much. I'm one of those people who subscribed to a local newspaper this year when the pandemic started for the first time since I've been living in Maine. In my case, the Portland Press Herald. And I want you guys to know that most of us really thank you for all the information we're giving you. 2020 has been a really rough year for me and my family. Firstly, because on New Year's Eve, my son was diagnosed with cancer. So we literally brought in 2020 with that devastating news. And I share that only to say that that actually has not been the worst thing about 2020, even though it's dominated every day of our lives. The worst thing for me has been about leadership and just the devastation that that Trump's not just lack of leadership, but negative leadership is doing to our country and to our communities, and turning, you know, neighbor against neighbor and bringing out really the worst in people. The way his supporters speak to their neighbors is just unimaginable to me. And in contrast, I just want to say, you know, on the bright side, you know, our cancer journey has brought out so much of our understanding of that unbelievable community who support cancer families. But for me, the hero of 2020 is Dr. Nirav Shah. And he is the anti-Trump in terms of his leadership in bringing out the best in people and being consistent and caring and hardworking and generous with everybody, no matter where they're coming from. And so I'm devastated on the one side, but on the other side, I have glimmers of hope in people like Dr. Shah.
Jeannie, thank you so much for your call and your thoughtfulness, and good luck with your son. I think that I know that you are not alone in your admiration for Dr. Shah. There's a whole Facebook fan group, which he is uncomfortable with, but it shows how many people admire him. We're going to go now to Kenneth Davis, who you'll recognize his name from his books and from his guest appearances on Maine Calling, the creator of the New York Times best-selling Don't Know Much About History books. Kenneth, welcome back.
Hello, Jennifer. Good morning. Good morning to all my friends and family in Maine. It's always a pleasure.
As a historian, how do you think 2020 will be viewed in 10, 20, or 100 years?
Well, let me start out by saying that my wife and I started out the new year in Milan, Italy, having a lovely time celebrating the new year in Milan. We came back a few days after that, and we were already starting to see the stories out of China, but quickly, of course, Italy became front and center, and we were, you know, astonished by what we were seeing. And so, having written a book 2 years ago about the Spanish flu pandemic and World War I, I was starting to take note of this before, you know, it really became front page news. And I have to say that early in March, when I was starting to talk about, having parades is a really bad idea. When they had parades in 1918, it killed hundreds of thousands of people. And that was a time they were still hadn't canceled the New York City St. Patrick's Day parade. So this did become, without question, the story of the year, and I'm sure the story that will be written about in history books, not only that it happened, but the response to it. It was the worst global pandemic in more than a century, and it shook everyone's expectations and assumptions. And as a historian, I have to say, we did not pay attention to the lessons of history. I've been speaking about that quite a bit, because we should have known that lies and propaganda and censorship kill, and they did in this case. We should know that misplaced priorities are lethal, and they were clearly, that was the big issue for this country early on, misplaced priorities. And finally, ignoring science is more deadly than war. And we've seen all of those things play out in a pandemic that there's no question much of the worst could have been avoided. You know, in 1918, Woodrow Wilson was the president. He never mentioned the Spanish flu. That was actually not even as bad as what happened here, where the president did the opposite of what was needed to do. And so I really feel that this is the story that, you know, will shape us. But as one of the other guests said earlier, we're not even talking about the fact that for only the third time in American history, a president was impeached in this country. It seems like a dim afterthought, way, way, way in the rearview mirror.
So, Ken, in your view, you know, 50 years from now, when students are reading in their U.S. history textbook that has to fit so much into one book, 2020 is going to be the year of COVID, not the year that Trump was defeated.
We don't know that. We don't know what will happen 2 years from now, let alone 4 years from now. And certainly, probably in 2012, a lot of people wouldn't have said Donald Trump would be president in 2016. So, you know, lots changes very quickly, and more so now than ever. We've been talking a lot about journalism here, and I think journalism is part of the story of the year. All of these of your other guests know that they've been under a different kind of pressure, an incredible kind of pressure. I think journalism has done an extraordinary job, for the most part, in balancing off the two big stories of basically of our lifetime. First of all, the pandemic, and then the election, which was about more than an election. It was really about a threat to American democracy, and I have to come back to that as part of the story here. We dodged a bullet in this election. An extraordinary number of people did turn out under really, really difficult circumstances, but we can't be too celebratory about that. The threats to democracy continue as we speak, and democracy does not die in darkness. I wrote about this, of course, in my last book, Strong Man, The Rise of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy. Democracy dies in broad daylight while thousands cheer, and it's often because of propaganda, lies, censorship, all of the things that we have seen playing out that journalism has to really respond to, and there has to be a kind of journalism for the new world. I think a lot of newspapers have you know, gotten caught up in the quest to get those clicks and those eyeballs, and that's a dangerous game in its own right. So there's no question in my mind that the election and the pandemic and the threat to democracy that we saw in America this year are kind of connected stories that will really shape this country for a while to come.
Well, Ken, it's always wonderful to hear from you. Kenneth C. Davis, creator of the best-selling line of Don't Know Much About History books, his latest book is Strong Man, The Rise and Fall of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy. Before we go to more calls, I want to ask our guests, Greg, Susan, and Ben, anything to add to what Ken said? Ben, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, as this pertains to journalism, I think what Ken said about how the Trump administration just kind of botched this, and even worse, the response to COVID. I think there's been some great reporting on how that happened and why we are at where we're at today. Yet I don't see the effect that that had on the American public. You know, the president let thousands, hundreds of thousands of people die this year without really doing anything. And although he lost the election, there hasn't been this kind of widespread repudiation that I would hope would come from a society that's had that happen, that's been abandoned by their leader. And that, you know, that's not even a question to a lot of people. You know, I don't know, something's not getting through. And that's a problem for journalism, I think, as we move forward. You know, we're doing all this great, people are doing all this great reporting, telling these great stories, getting people the facts they need, and people are just ignoring them.
Susan.
Yeah. I would turn that into a question for Ken. I wonder what his thoughts are on how the media can communicate with the people who distrust us.
Oh, darn. I let him go. Greg, what about you?
Because that's his next book. Yeah, you know, I think Ken made a point that we don't really know how these events will be viewed because we don't know what happens next. And is this the start of something, you know, positive, or is this, you know, did we get a momentary respite from a decline in democracy? I read a quote recently by the author Jenny Offel, who had written a book called Weather, which is about living during, you know, climate catastrophe and day-to-day life. And she was asked why she was optimistic, and she said, because we don't know what's going to happen, you know. So I guess that's a reason to be hopeful, if not expecting good things to happen, you know, that the future is dark to us. And we don't know. So that's going to affect how we view the things we're living through. A lot of times, you know, you think you're living through a time of great change, and then you look back and go, well, that really wasn't, you know, that was, you know, I was more at a crosswalk than a crossroads. So, this is clearly a time, you know, where everything is being reevaluated and questioned. And do we move in a positive direction towards more democracy, more trusting of each other, or is it, you know, or is this when we're all going to come apart?
And speaking of optimism, we have Marfine in Portland. Hi, Marfine.
All right. Hi. I know, you know, this recent weeks, you know, we've seen nominations from President-elect Biden that have been nothing but historic, with Deb Haaland for Secretary of the Interior, and then Michael Regan for EPA and Rep. Marsha Fudge for HUD. And Greg, you mentioned sort of a reevaluation or a reckoning. And I think, you know, this gives us an opportunity to not only see representation in our own democracy and our own government, but, you know, a reckoning with, you know, what, you know, hasn't been done in the past and what needs to be done now, especially in the wake of Black Lives Matter and different issues around racial injustice.
Marfine, thanks so much for calling in and sharing your thoughts. Apparently we have Ken back. Ken, Susan said she wanted to turn the question around and ask you how she thinks the media can reach the rest of the public better.
This is a really big, hard question. Thanks, Jennifer, for coming back to me. And I really am grateful for these guys and what they have to say. It's so important. Part of the problem here, and we haven't really mentioned it here, is that we have, you know, we don't have a media in this country. We have different media and sometimes as sharply divided and sometimes leading that divide in many ways. So the people who, you know, still believe, a large number of people who still believe that the election was rigged and phony are listening to the media. That's telling them that. And so how we battle the idea that certain media are not dedicated to bringing truth and light and justice to the world, but are promoting an agenda is one of the real problems for our society. And because it doesn't just apply to the newspapers and the television stations, it goes down the line to what's happening in social media. So this is a really, really big issue. It's something that we discussed actually a few weeks ago when we were talking about education, because teachers are having this exact same problem in their schools. And they are teaching their kids, and many, many young people I talk to are far more aware of the media imbalance. And I'd also say one other thing, which is that they are turning away from the traditional media. How many kids are getting their news from, you know, YouTube, Instagram, and the like? So this is a real social question, and I don't really have a nice, simple answer, except that we do have to maintain the belief that facts are stubborn things, and we have to keep sticking to that basic truth.
Well, Kenneth C. Davis, thanks for calling back. At this point, we do need to take another break. We're talking about the year in review. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bristol Seafood's My Fish Dish, garlic and herb butter shrimp, and three other varieties found in the freezer at your local Hannaford. And Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com.
I'm Mark Vogelzang, president of Maine Public. And on this day in Maine's history, in 1959, the first national Christmas tree to come from east of the Mississippi River was lit on the south lawn of the White House by President Eisenhower. The 70-foot-tall white spruce came from Presque Isle in Arista County, where it had been harvested from the Alice Kimball Farm on Parsons Road. It was estimated to be 85 years old and weighed approximately 3 tons. The tree was shipped from Presque Isle on 2 railroad flat cars and traveled to Washington courtesy of the Bangor and Aroostook Railroad, the Maine Central Railroad, Boston and Maine, the Delaware and Hudson, and Pennsylvania Railroads. Happy birthday, Maine!
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher, Maine Masons, and listeners like you.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. With the coronavirus vaccine going into arms around the world, you may be dreaming of a post-pandemic return to normalcy. Physician and sociologist Nicholas Christakis says you may have to wait 2 years or more.
Then I think it'll be a little bit like the Roaring Twenties 100 years ago after the 1918 pandemic.
That's next time on Here and Now.
And that's coming up today at noon here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, The Year in Review, joining us our panel of editorial page editors, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now, Julie Murchison Harris, who is a Bangor Daily News' weeklies editor that covers Aroostook County. Julie, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Thank you. Good to be back. Good morning.
What were the biggest stories of this year in Aroostook County?
Well, there were many. Well, certainly we were part of the national political scene. The Collins-Gideon race really found its way to Aroostook County, Collins being a Caribou native. The COVID situation is really just hitting Aroostook County. They were pretty insulated from it until a couple of months ago, and now cases are rising there. So they're kind of where the rest of the state was a few months ago in that process, and that is just becoming a big story for them. One of our biggest things is some school projects that we had going on. Caribou finally finished its consolidated school that took them 10 years from the decision to build one until students arrived in it in November. So that was a really big deal for the Caribou area. We also have a couple of school projects that are part of a state pilot program to help smaller rural schools deal with declining enrollment and cut costs by consolidating into regional schools. one of those projects has had the plug pulled on it. That's the Southern Aroostook one. The state has pulled the funding for that because too many districts dropped out. And the other one that is all but dead is in the St. John Valley, the Valley Unified proposed school. The state has set a deadline of December 31st for pulling the plug on that. And the group can't agree up there on how they want to govern that school. So that's probably going
and
away.
Yeah, and Julie, we've spent a lot of today's discussion on COVID-19, obviously the biggest story of the year, of the decade, even further. In Aroostook County, it has, you know, this. You still have the same kinds of things when you have businesses that are hurt by it and people worried about their own health and the health of their neighbors. But then there's also the border, which is such an important part of the economy, part of people's lives. And the border has been closed since March, right?
Yes, it has. And it looks like it won't be open until at least the spring, if then. And that is really becoming a problem for people. Families are split up. Border businesses are suffering from it.
Mm. What are you looking forward to in 2021?
Oh, a more peaceful life, I think.
Not something a journalist often says. oh, my. Well,
We're hoping for COVID recovery, of course, as everyone is. We'll have to deal with whatever the aftermath is of the failed regional school in the St. John Valley.
Right.
But exciting news in the St. John Valley, even as the school is going off the table, is that we're going to be getting a new international bridge up there. So hopefully that goes out to bid this spring, and construction on that will start this year.
And people will be able to cross it. Julie, yeah. Thank you so much for giving us a call. Julie Murchison-Harris, the Bangor Daily News Weekly's editor. You know, I think we've made it so far in this conversation, Ben, and I'm going to turn to you for this, without talking about how much money was spent in the race for Senate.
Yeah, really kind of run out of adjectives to describe the amount of spending. You know, we started early on when they were reporting these huge hauls, and then that kept on going through the summer. And we were all wondering, you know, how are they going to spend it all? And, you know, one way was on all those ads that everyone got sick of, and that seemed to not have a effect on anything. And even with all that, you know, Sarah Gideon still has a lot of money left over. She's got more money left over than it used to take to run both races together not too long ago. So it's really become, you know, because of the high profile race, and because of how it ended up with the Susan Collins winning, despite the polls that didn't look so good for her, you know, it's become this this target of, you know, rightfully so, of an example of an, you know, of overspending and the amount of money in politics. And it seems like whenever we talk about money in politics going forward, we're going to talk about that Collins-Gideon race now.
An email here from Elizabeth. One of the most promising events of 2020 has been the amplification of the Black Lives Matter movement. Police brutality and the death of George Floyd and countless others in recent and non-recent history is the shame of our nation. But the changes being made due to the tireless efforts of those demonstrating for systemic transformation gives me hope. Conversely, the reactions of police and national security forces and the backlash from those who don't understand systemic racism is troubling. All in all, though, it feels like these conflicts coming to a head provides an opportunity for all to learn and for our society to grow. Greg, I know you've written about this.
Yeah, no, it's certainly one of the big stories of the year, and it is one that, you know, is going to reverberate through the future. It's always a question in a place like Maine that is got such a low minority population, how these issues will resonate, and in this case,
There were massive demonstrations here, and I think a lot of young people, a lot of people of all different races and backgrounds, that they're going to carry that experience, you know, through their lives. That's what happens. You know, people who grew up protesting against the Vietnam War when they were young affected their politics for their entire lives. And so I think that's going to be the legacy of it. You know, the question is how does it translate into, you know, a program and in terms of policy and what people can agree on, what kind of reforms are needed, or whether, you know, reform is sometimes considered not enough to even discuss. So that, you know, that's the kind of thing that's going to be creating tension in the months and years ahead. But it is certainly for some reason, and I think COVID played a role in it, the injustice that was evident in the death of George Floyd was the last straw for a number of people. And you know, we saw it happen, and we are witnessing the response.
An email here from Grayson. A couple of words I'm sick of hearing this year are unprecedented and crisis. 2020 has exposed so many systems in decline, but I'm inclined to look for silver linings. 2020 has taught me to prioritize self-care over making a buck. I hope when this is all over, more people will learn to respect science and prioritize what truly matters. Lives, health, and community. Hopefully we'll look back on this year and think that was a turning point towards something better. Susan, I suspect Grayson is not alone.
Absolutely. I mean, you hate to sound kind of Pollyanna about it. As you mentioned, record number of cases today, horrifying number of deaths from COVID, but there have been some bright spots. You know, like everyone else, working from home certainly has its good moments and its bad moments, having college kids studying at home, you know, also good and bad, but, you know, being able to spend more time with family members, you know, there's a lot of little positives, spending more time outside, reconnecting virtually with people, you know, that live far away in place of getting together with friends locally. There have been a lot of positive things that have happened, but, you know, to tie in with the previous topic, so much work yet to do on so many issues, including racial equality, and, you know, some good progress being made with representation, both, you know, first Black assistant House Majority Leader in Maine. We have our first Black Vice President, Deb Haaland's nomination at Department of Interior. You know, it's slow, but we're certainly making progress on that front and on others as well. So Grayson's right. It's hard to remember, but there are things to be thankful for.
Andrew, thank you for calling in. Calling from Central Maine. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. I've been amazed this year at how reflected I think our leadership has been in people around me. I've been struck by the amount of, for example, non-fact-based thinking that has led to real unproductive behaviors in the country. And I think the thing that surprised me the most is how similar this pandemic on so many levels has reflected other pandemics. And you can read Barbara Tuchman's book about the 14th century, for example, and, you know, everything went topsy-turvy to the extent that the pandemic was powerful until leadership started paying attention to the scientists, and then things turned around. And, you know, the dynamics of protecting the economy are real. We really need to, but it's not going to happen until the pandemic is really tamed. And it just amazes me that we are repeating so many things that have happened in the past, but the situation is just real and personal.
Yeah. Andrew, thank you for your thoughts on that. And, you know, we're kind of tight on time. Ben, I'll turn to you. This is a reminder that maybe sometimes we think we're so advanced, but we're repeating some of the same mistakes that humanity has been making for a long, long time, and not just the 1918 pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, humans are humans, and we, you know, a lot has changed around us, but we haven't changed. And, you know, we're still scared and superstitious and tribal and all those things. And then when things get rough, like they did this year, those attributes come out more than others, and we really have to fight to get over to them. And that's what Andrew was saying about leadership, is you need leadership to guide you through something like this. And we've had it in some places and not in others. And, you know, when we look back at 2020, I think we're going to find out that it just wasn't enough.
And I'm going to repeat here for an email from Christine. The tireless work of the Maine CDC and Dr. Nirav Shah has been a model of clarity, communication, and integrity, and yes, kindness. Such a major help during this extremely challenging time. So a lot of people looking back at 2020 and not fondly, to say the least, most of us. But a lot of people with compliments for Dr. Shah. I want to thank our guest today for being with us not only today, but throughout the year. The voice you just heard, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor of the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Also with us, Susan Young, the editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, and Greg Kesich, the editorial page editor of the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Okay, I'm going to take a big breath here. Today's sound engineer was Lucy Suchek. And as if 2020 wasn't bad enough, today we say farewell to Lucy. She is off to grad school to study something good, journalism. We couldn't be more proud or happier for her, but she will be missed. Lucy's a wonderful addition to Maine Calling and Maine Public. She's a Maine kid who grew up in MDI and graduated from Colby. It's her voice you often hear on the air with us. And she's had a terrific attitude and just an excellent sound engineer. And you may not know this, but she produced a couple Maine Calling programs. So bye, Lucy. We're going to welcome you back after graduate school, we hope. With that, Cindy, Jonathan, and I thank you for staying with us this past year. Tomorrow and Friday, Maine Public will be broadcasting special holiday programs, so you will not be hearing Maine Calling. And next week, we're going to listen back to a few of our favorite shows. Thank you for listening. Stay safe. Happy holidays and Happy New Year to you all. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.